Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Thomas S. Mullaney. He's an associate professor of history at Stanford University, and we're talking about his latest book, The Chinese Typewriter, A History. Tom, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I want to mention that this is volume one of a two-volume series. What's going to be in volume two?
Volume two is going to pick up where the first volume leaves off, right at the beginning of computation, word processing, and we'll take it from basically the immediate post-World War II period all the way up to the present day of new media.
This is a really fascinating history, and I had no idea. I'd always been interested in the development of the Chinese typewriter, and I couldn't imagine what this history was like. But it really starts out as a history between sort of the attempted hegemony of letter alphabet-based writing versus character-based writing. I mean, it really is. As you mentioned in the book, Morse code, Braille, stenography, typewriting, linotype, punch card, memory, all was developed first with the Latin alphabet in mind. And the attitude always was there was something wrong with the Chinese language.
That's exactly right. I mean, there was, you know, where a minority of engineers were raising questions and saying, you know, maybe we should be saying to ourselves that it's not the Chinese script that has a problem; it's the typewriter as we know it that has a problem, or it's not Chinese character-based writing that has the problem; it's the way we have structured Morse code and the semiotic system of telegraphy that has the problem. That's a really hard case to be made. It's understand that it didn't get a lot of traction because, of course, companies like Remington and Underwood, although they had failed to break into the Chinese market, which they really, really wanted to get into, although they had failed in this market, they had succeeded with Hebrew and Russian and Arabic to varying degrees of success. And so they almost became, I think, intoxicated by this success and began to believe their own press in a sense that they had built a truly universal language agnostic device. And in fact, just like you said, one after the next of modern information technologies are anything but neutral. They're deeply, deeply political from
start to
finish.
That's right.
It's the Chinese script that is sort of the observer of this politics most acutely.
Well, taken for example, and I'm so glad you brought this up, you start back with old cartoons about imagining what the Chinese typewriter looked like. And I'm sure this is what most people think. Mm-hmm. And the amazing thing, and I never even put this together until your book, that trope goes all the way through things like LL Cool J. Talk about that.
No, it's an amazing consistency. So the cartoon or the style of cartoon in question, which begin to show up almost right exactly at the year 1900, and these are cartoons in which the cartoonist imagines a Chinese typewriter as the size of a building with thousands and thousands and thousands of keys upon which the typist can't stand in front of it and manipulate the keys the way one would a Remington, but actually the typewriter is bigger than the typist and the typist runs around its surface. And this image, which of course, you know, there is no typewriter in existence that ever looked like that, but this image is alive and well all the way now into the 21st century, long after typewriters have been replaced and supplanted. And it shows up in The Simpsons. It shows up in Tom Selleck films. It shows up in the music and music video of "You Can't Touch This" by MC Hammer. It's still in the zeitgeist, I guess, or the sort of spirit of the age.
And it's deeply racist.
It is. It's. I mean, the imagery itself. The point, especially when you look at the images in 1900. I mean, they're
awful.
They are dehumanizing. They're
classic racist stereotypes.
Exactly. But there's something that I try to make this point in the book, and I've had conversations with many and try to, you know, get this point across. There is a transition though that happens where, let's say, by the time we get to the 19 the midpoint of the 20th century into the 60s and into the 70s and 80s, during a time when, for a variety of reasons, civil rights movement, broader discussions and critical analysis of these kinds of racist stereotypes, people stop producing cartoons in which there are highly racialized portrayals of the Chinese typist, the person using it. And yet, the trope of the Chinese language and writing system being fundamentally anti-modern, fundamentally backward, fundamentally at odds with modernity continue, and it kind of sanitizes the whole discourse. A person can make a very, very culturalist claim about how Chinese script is totally impossible in the realm of IT, and yet steer wide clear of anything that might get them, you know, might get others to say, "Hey, you're making a kind of a race-based argument here." They get to have their cake and eat it too, in a kind of new form of essentialism that surrounds the technology as opposed to culture or biology. So I think that these images of the Chinese typewriter are doing a lot of work, a lot of political work, even if they seem like neutral statements when people talk about how difficult Chinese is.
There are two words you use early on in the book, pluremic and synemic. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So these are highly technical terms, but that basically boil down to the idea of a writing system in which the pieces of the writing system, let's say letters, have absolutely, they themselves carry no meaning or semantic meaning. They are artificial graphic units that a person is supposed to combine and to, you know, combine letters into words. Represent the sounding out of a word in a language. So the idea is, okay, the writing system is totally artificial with respect to meaning. And this has been contrasted against, and these are really popular misunderstandings about, well, writing systems, not just Chinese, but also hieroglyphics and Mayan and other kinds of scripts that are typically characterized as pictographic, which Chinese is by and large not a pictographic writing system. But in any event, the idea is these writing systems, the units of language in the units of writing are, in a sense, meaningful. They are pictures of something in reality. And over the course of the 1800s, 1900s, there was a popular idea. First, it began in sort of academic circles, and then it began to popularize that artificial or empty languages or synemic languages are inherently fundamentally superior to those like, and again, these are characterized versions of pictographic hieroglyphics or pictographic Chinese. They are more sort of susceptible to the analytical mind and so forth and so on. And, this is still an idea that is alive and well when people, they don't use those terms necessarily, but people still fundamentally believe in many, many circles that letter-based writing is somehow fundamentally more compatible with information and modernity than a character-based system.
I find this whole thing incredible because if you look at the history of Chinese culture and civilization, they were sort of ahead of the curve of the rest of the world for a long time.
Yeah. This idea is a very new one. I mean, if you go back to the 1500s and you've got foreigners visiting China and also Japan, they are blown away by the low cost, high quality of printed Chinese books. And these are typically, you know, movable type was invented in China, but for the most part, woodblock printing or xylographic printing was the technology of choice for printing books in China. And when Jesuits visitors came and other foreigners came, they were deeply impressed by this. And in fact, by one estimation, by one scholar, the number of printed books in Chinese at one point in the early modern period may have been greater in quantity than the printed books or printed matter of all other languages combined. So the idea that somehow Chinese as a writing system was holding China back and so forth is an idea that only begins to take shape and then gain traction in the 1800s and 1900s. And now history is starting to take a different trajectory. And suddenly, you know, China is now the largest IT and computing market, new media market in the world. And hopefully for people that are observing that, they're maybe scratching their head and saying, wait a minute, how did this happen? Chinese still has characters, so this was never supposed to happen if we followed the idea that alphabets have supremacy over character-based writing. There's got to be another story to this.
But, you know, it's interesting, and I want to make sure I read this correctly. In the book, you said that the eventual invention of the Chinese typewriter, which we'll hopefully get to, did not transform the government or modern Chinese corporations.
No, it did not. I mean, and I try to be really, you know, honest and clear about that in the book is, so the history of the Chinese typewriter can't be narrated in the same way as the history of the Remington and Underwood and so forth. It didn't change the fundamental nature of business culture, of women's place in the workforce, and a lot of other stories that we know, you know, pretty well in the study of the Western typewriter. I try to make the point that the real story, I think, of the Chinese typewriter is not its impact, let's say, or its output in this sort of Elizabeth Eisenstein and the printing press and how its output changed the world. I think instead it is a story of this incredibly intense, incredibly sort of deep kind of critical thought that went in to the creation of this device. It was the creation of this device rather than what this device did right away in its lifetime, so to speak, that I think the really interesting part of this history is found. And then, just having said that, the place where we do get to a kind of impact style history, an influence style history, is when we begin to see the transition between typewriting and computing, because early in the history of Chinese computing, all sorts of principles and ideas and methods that had been worked out over decades and decades in the typewriting realm begin to be migrated into the realm of computing. And then suddenly that's where you start to see, I guess, the impact of the Chinese typewriter after its life is over, in a sense.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Thomas S. Mullaney, Associate Professor of History at Stanford University. And we're talking about his latest book. It's really an interesting history, The Chinese Typewriter, A History. Tom, I want to make sure we get to the typewriter, because we could be talking about just the first parts of the book forever. But it becomes obvious that the Chinese needed a typewriter of their own. This is in your own words. The inventors had to depart from convention. They essentially had to reimagine what a typewriter did. Instead of using the Remington model and just sort of fiddling around with it, which is what they were doing for things like Hebrew and other languages, there really needed to be a reconception of what the typewriter would look like.
That's absolutely true. I mean, the way I've been thinking about it is that, you know, the engineers and linguists and, you know, and business people who are trying, not just in China, but all around the world, it became a kind of magnetic question. How do you build a typewriter for Chinese? It's just a almost hypnotically interesting puzzle. They knew from the outset that we need to reimagine and be willing to reimagine not just the Chinese writing system and try to rethink what that is and what it means and what we can do with it, but we also have to rethink what a typewriter is. We have to have the barest minimum definition of what a typewriter is. If we say to ourselves, you know, by definition, a typewriter has to be an object that has a keyboard, we are already in difficult waters here. But there is no, you know, Moses did not hear from God that typewriters have keyboards. There's no rule written in any constitution, in any religious text that says a typewriter is a thing with keyboard. And in fact, if you go back to the early years of the Western typewriter, and in its kind of in the Wild West of the 1870s, 80s, 90s in early English alphabetic typewriting, you see all sorts of different typewriters. You see typewriters with no keyboards. You see typewriters with double-sized keyboards. You see, you know, typewriters you can manipulate with one hand. And that broader kind of diversity and ecology of the early decades of Western typewriting basically entirely dies out by the turn of the 20th century, and all we're left with is a monoculture of the Remington-style single-shift keyboard. And so in a certain way, the engineers who want to build a typewriter for Chinese, you could look at this two ways. Either they are thinking way outside the box and totally reimagining what a typewriter could be so that they could, you know, solve the puzzle. Or you could also say that they were re-excavating the forgotten histories, the forgotten earlier histories of the Western typewriter.
That's
and saying,
right.
You know, why don't we bring that one out of obscurity, out of its forgotten state, and think about it. Lo and behold, this is a perfect approach, maybe not a perfect, but the near perfect approach, way better than the Remington, for trying to solve the puzzle we have at hand. And on one point they were vociferous, which is, as one engineer put it, Chinese characters are innocent. Chinese characters have committed no crime. If an engineer just looks at the Chinese, you know, characters and 70,000 plus characters and says this is impossible, then it's the engineer who is at fault in that statement, not the language in question. So they forget thinking outside the box. They had to forget that the box even existed and start all over again.
Now, you're going to have to forgive me if I mispronounce people's names, but I want to mention one of the first key characters in this, and it's Zhou Hukun.
Oh, yes, exactly, Zhou Hukun.
Now, this is the first true Chinese typewriter. A real challenge for you is going to be try to at least give the listener an idea of what this looks like. And the great thing is you've seen some of the early examples still preserved.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So talk. Machine. So he came to America from China. How did he envision this typewriter?
Well, so he is a fascinating character. He studies abroad. He is one of the, you know, one of the students brilliant enough and fortunate enough to get funding to travel abroad. And originally, you know, his education path at MIT, which is where he studied, was in aeronautical engineering. He was the first student in the United States of any nationality, any student in the United States, to receive a Master's of Science in Aeronautical Engineering from MIT. And, you know, this is one of the useful disciplines that China needed for modernization. But he fell in love along the way with questions of language and questions of writing. And he had this one kind of epiphany moment when he saw a demonstration of, I think it was the monotype machine, demonstrated somewhere in the Boston area or the Cambridge area. And so he set out on the machine, and one of the first things he said was, this cannot look like the Western typewriter that we see everywhere. It just won't work that way. And so what he ends up doing is he goes down one of the paths to trying to solve the Chinese typewriter puzzle, which ends up being the method, the mass manufactured way. And this is called common usage, or the common usage approach. And what he says is basically, okay, how do we fit 70,000 plus characters on a machine? The answer is we don't. The answer is we instead want to undertake a rigorous statistical analysis of Chinese texts, newspapers, textbooks, you know, fiction. We want to count up one by one by one by one how many times each character shows up in this million plus character corpus. So really tedious kind of proto-digital humanities kind of work. And then we want to figure out of these tens of thousands of characters, which ones are really critical, absolutely essential to be on the machine, and which ones can we afford to leave off of the machine? And he arrives at a figure of roughly 3,000 characters. And many other people were studying this, and they kind of arrived at a similar number. They said, okay, 3,000 doesn't get us everything, but it gets us about 85 to 90% of everything that the average person would use. And in his case, his first prototype, he took these characters and arrayed them on a cylinder that was affixed to the machine and would rotate on the machine like a sort of a, I don't know, a massive, I don't know, let's say a rolling pin, let's say. And then there was this, there was a guide that was encased typically in glass in front of him that had a diagram of all the characters on his machine. And then he would use, I believe it was his right hand, he would use his right hand to pull this pointer, which was this little kind of thing attached to the chassis of the machine. He would pull the pointer and have the pointer over top of the character on that glass encased guide that the typist wanted. As he was pulling the pointer to the character on the guide, that would cause the cylinder to rotate and also to traverse left and right, in essence bringing the corresponding metal character, obviously in mirror image so that it prints correctly, into the printing position. And when it was in the printing position, he would depress this type lever and cause it to impress. Now, there was a problem with this design. And it wasn't, people might be thinking, oh, how did someone memorize where the characters are? Actually, that wasn't the problem. That was something that people were very, very good at doing. The problem was, is that in his original design, the cylinder of characters was fixed. You couldn't change those characters. They were embedded in the, you know, the structure of the cylinder. And so what do you do if you work at a law firm or a university, right, or you have a boss who's has an uncommon surname in Chinese and you need to use it all the time? Well, you're kind of, you know, you're kind of at a loss. You could write the characters in by hand, but, you know, that defeats the purpose of having this typewriter. And so he eventually he gets the interest of this huge manufacturing and print company back in China. They try in the beginning to mass manufacture it, but then they part ways. There's still problems with getting it. And he parts ways, goes back to his earlier life in engineering, and this other gentleman, Xu Jiandong, comes along, is hired by the same company to take over the typewriter project, and he has a very interesting solution for this. Let's get rid of the cylinder. Let's just put all of these 2,500 to 3,000 characters onto a rectangular flat grid. And this is the important part, you can change the characters. The characters are loose in the machine. They're not fixed to anything metal. All you need is a pair of tweezers, and you can just pluck out a character you might not need and replace it with one that you do. And so it becomes the first, to my knowledge, the first mass-manufactured typewriter in anywhere in the world that is fully customizable. It can be changed, in essence. And as you can probably tell, as your listeners are thinking, they haven't heard the word keyboard yet, and that's for a simple reason. There was no keyboard, and there was never a keyboard on any of the mass-manufactured Chinese typewriters in history. This was a typewriter without a keyboard.
Now, one of the things that made a comeback was divisible type. Can you talk about that?
So while Zhou Hokun and Xu Jiandong are doing their stuff and deciding we're going to count up characters and only put a small number on the machine, there are other people out there who are trying to solve the Chinese typewriter puzzle in a totally different way. And another route that was experimented with is known as divisible type. You can also think of as combinatorialism, where you basically don't try to limit the number of characters based on frequency. Instead, what you want to do is you want to explode Chinese characters into the component pieces that make them up. And these are sometimes referred to as radicals, sometimes referred to as phonetics, but there's a variety of names for them. But the challenge is that these pieces that show up repeatedly in all Chinese characters, they're not always in the same position in a Chinese character. They're not always the same size when they appear in a Chinese character. They could be on the left side, on the top side, on the bottom. And so for decades, scholars were contemplating this idea, and they said, okay, how many individual metal pieces do we need such that we could spell, quote-unquote, any Chinese character in existence with this number?
Essentially piecing it together by the strokes.
Not by the strokes. It'd be by the sort of structural little pieces that are made up of strokes.
If you were to be inking it, those would be strokes.
Individual. Yeah, you would do it in separate pieces.
So what was the minimal number that they could use?
Roughly 2,000. They figured out that if they had 2,000 some odd metal pieces with all of these different parts on them, and they put that onto a typewriter, they could build up any Chinese character in existence, and in fact, they could make up new ones if they wanted to. So it was a totally different approach to the idea of how we solve the typewriter puzzle. And in this case, the challenge was not the question of characters that were missing from the machine, because in theory, no characters were missing from the machine. You could build anyone you want. The real challenge with this approach was aesthetic. The characters that these kinds of machines produced were often considered to be of low aesthetic quality. They were too spread out. They were too loose. They didn't cohere well. Is that those weren't ever built.
It's important to emphasize that the tradition of calligraphic art is long and huge in China as well as in other cultures, and therefore caring about the look of the character is really an important quality. I mean, that's an important quality to the culture. I mean, and you go into that in the book. By the way, we're almost out of time, and we've only started to talk about this book. There are chapters on Chinese typists, the job, and there's also a fascinating chapter for me on the connection between Japan and China during World War II. And you end the book with a really fascinating description of Chinese keyboards on computers. And I had no idea. I assumed. I didn't know how they worked. And I assume that's what the next book is going to be about, is fleshing out the development of that.
That's exactly right. So the book.
Man, that was tempting. I read that and I was like, wow.
Yeah, no, it's the book ends with, in my view, a moment in the history of global information technology that is every bit as momentous as the Gutenberg Revolution,
Absolutely.
As the Telegraphic
Absolutely.
Revolution, and this is the creation of an entirely new kind of human-machine or human-computer interaction, which has such a neutral-sounding name that it can often be overlooked, and this is input. So the QWERTY keyboard is everywhere in the Chinese-speaking world now, but it functions nothing like
it.
Keyboard in the English language world.
Oh, man.
It's a totally different beast.
When is the second book coming out? Because I can hardly wait.
I promise to send you a copy as soon as it's ready. I hesitate to give it a date.
Oh, no! My guest tonight has been Thomas S. Mullaney, Associate Professor of History at Stanford University. And we're talking about his latest book, and we only scratched the surface. The Chinese Typewriter, A History. This is a really, if you're interested in linguistics and technology, this is an amazing book. Thomas, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.